Hello and welcome to the Displaced African podcast. The Displaced African is the African immigrant's personal development blog. It can be found at www.thedisplacedafrican.com. Hello everybody, this is Mwangi here, and today's podcast is with Derek Ashong. Now, Derek is probably most famous for a YouTube video, which I've linked to within this post, where he talked about why he supports Obama. It was one where this guy came with a camera and started asking him very aggressive questions about why do you support Obama, and really wanted to get into more detail, and he really shone through and became a YouTube superstar that day. That video has been seen more than a million times. So if you want to see the video, just go to YouTube and look for Derek Ashong, and Ashong is spelled A-S-H-O-N-G, and Derek is D-E-R-R-I-C-K, and look for the Obama video that's been watched a million times. Aside from that, Derek is a lot more than that. He's a Ghanaian immigrant to the U.S., but before immigrating to the U.S. for the final time, he lived in Saudi Arabia, he lived in Qatar, and he lived in the Middle East, and he's also a professional speaker. He went to Harvard, and today we'll be talking to him as DNA, who is the frontman of his band called Soulfege, and Soulfege is S-O-U-L-F-E-G-E. This is a two-part interview. It's an hour long, so I split it into two 30-minute sections. And just before we get started, let me encourage you to go to the band's Facebook page, which can be found at facebook.com/soulfege, S-O-U-L-F-E-G-E, and become a friend of theirs. And also, head on over to iTunes tomorrow, that is July the 15th. Head on over to iTunes and pick up their new album called Take the Mic. So the second part of this interview comes out tomorrow. I hope you enjoy the first. This is Mwangi here. Enjoy. Hello, this is Mwangi here, and today I'm here with Derek Ashong. How are you, Derek?
I'm doing very well, sir. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. So, Derek, so let people know where you're coming from. Talk a bit about your early life, where you came from, and where you are now.
Absolutely. I was born in Ghana, in Accra, West Africa. And when I was a kid, I moved to Brooklyn, New York, and then at age 8, I moved to Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, and then when I was 12, I moved to Doha, which is in Qatar, in the Arabian Gulf. Then I moved back to the United States for my junior year of high school when I was 16.
And you've been in the States ever since?
Yeah, I've been based in the States ever since. I still stay pretty well connected back home. I try to go at least once a year in recent years. But I live in the United States. Right now I'm actually in Los Angeles.
Okay. And something I hear about all the time, I'm here in Australia, so I wouldn't know very much about this, is that apparently there's quite a bit of friction between like African Americans and Africans. Apparently they call Africans like African booty scratcher and all these sorts of things, and Africans call African Americans akatas, which is like a beast. So talk a little bit about that. Is that true? Is it nuanced?
I think that there is some element of tension, but it may be overstated. So I do believe that there typically are good relations between Africans and African Americans, but I think that one thing that has happened is that people in both communities have fallen prey to the misguided notions about who and what we are. And so you have all of these stereotypes of African Americans that exist in mainstream American society, that they're this or that, or, you know, lazy, or that they're criminal, or they're not intelligent. And Africans come in and buy into many of the stereotypes that anyone else does. Meanwhile, you have all these stereotypes of Africans that were poor, were all starving, that were desperate just to survive, and that Africa is hopeless, and an African cannot make anything of themselves in the absence of assistance from the West. And African Americans buy into some of those stereotypes as well. And so I think that part of it is people just not having a real understanding or real connection with folks from another culture and just believing what they hear on TV. At the same time, there's a flip side of that. You know, there are stereotypes that people in Ghana have, that African Americans are all rich and they're like the upper class in American society. I've had people literally say this to me, and they've all got bars and lots of girls, and they just live the high life, and they're really dangerous, and a lot of them are criminal, but boy, do they make money. Not realizing that 50% of the brothers in New York City are unemployed. right?
Yep.
Meanwhile, you have African Americans who believe that, oh my God, Africa is the motherland, it's the home of all culture and humanity, and that's where all the kings and the queens, and everyone in Africa is beautiful and proud and they're wealthy, and when we were in Africa, we were all kings and queens. And I'm like, yo, if everybody's a king and queen, who is sweeping the streets, right? So on a practical level, I think there's not a major beef between Africans and African Americans. There are certain misunderstandings that can be very readily dealt with by real substantive interchange and trying to seek to know more about each other's cultures.
Okay. So what was your relationship after you showed up in junior high? Was it back in Brooklyn, or where did you go back to?
Well, it wasn't junior high, actually. I spent all of junior high in the Middle East. It was high school.
High school.
I mean, I had 2 years of school in the U.S. before going to college. So I'd already made it through half of high school in the Middle East, and it was a massive culture shock coming back here. First of all, I come in as this kid with, like, a completely different cultural background. I've grown up, you know, every 4 years until I was 20, I moved to a new country. All my friends are multilingual. I have a weird accent that's like a combination of all these different places and people that I've grown up with. The kids in my high school have never been south of of D.C. or north of New York, and so they have no idea what to do with somebody like me. And, of course, with kids, if you come in as something different, then it's automatically a threat. It's like less than. But I also had a certain amount of confidence in myself, and so I wasn't really trying to have anybody put me down. So there were some kinds of tensions. But additionally, I didn't know certain things that are like accepted in American culture that are not spoken of in polite society, but that are accepted. Like, I didn't know that black people are supposed to be dumb. No one had told me that as a young black kid, I should be getting lesser grades or be more in trouble or not good at math or anything. So I'm getting A's all over the place. I'm accepted to Harvard. I'm like blowing up the standardized test because nobody gave me the memo. Okay? And so then people are like, oh, well, you're not like the others. You're not like it. I'm like, not like the other what? Like, not like, you know, you're different. different from what? You mean I'm smarter than you? And all the other, because you're talking about I'm different from the black kids, but I get better grades than the white kids too. So what are you talking about? Like, I don't get it. And it took me a while to realize what the implication was and what people were trying to get at. And so it was a big shock, but you know, you survived.
Okay. And so you ended up in Harvard. How did that happen? And what was Harvard like?
Well, the Harvard thing happened. It's a kind of a long story, but in a nutshell, I was at an event. A summer program, and some kids were having some dialogue about affirmative action, and someone was making foolish statements about how black people get all the good spots and they take all the great college spots, which is really very evident by the fact that you have more young black men in prison than in college. Obviously, black people are taking all the good spots, and that 11% of the community, half of a significant chunk of which is in prison, they are the ones that are making it possible for you not to go to school. I mean, it became very obvious that people were making excuses and they were scapegoating. And I was offended at this idea that, like, wait a minute, you think that I'm less qualified and people are talking about, oh, so-and-so is taking their spot and someone might be taking your spot. And I'm like, what made it your spot in the first place? You know, if you could answer the question of why you feel so entitled that this belongs to you, then maybe we can have a substantive conversation about race in America. But what I felt after that is I was like, yo, a lot of these kids were talking about, oh, I want to apply to Harvard. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I'm like, you know what? I feel like I am not only just as smart as anyone, but smarter than a lot of people. And if Harvard is the proof of pudding of that, then shoot, we apply to Harvard. I'm applying to Harvard. I applied just for fun. I didn't really want to go. I wanted to go to Brown. So I applied to two colleges, Harvard and Brown. And I applied to Harvard early, and then I got in. And, you know, African parents, it was like, hey, you're going to Harvard? You're going. I was like, yo, but I don't want to be with all these stuck-up rich kids and blah, blah, blah. They were like, no, it's okay. You're going. I was like, isn't this my choice? They're like, no, it's not your choice.
So typical.
Go read your books. And that's how I wound up there.
Oh, and what did you study at Harvard?
I did Afro-American studies, actually. I started out with government. And I was looking at political science. I wanted to look at political trends in the United States and in Africa. And
I wound up taking an introductory course that I heard about when I was in high school visiting Harvard. And it was taught by a professor named Kwame Anthony Appiah. And I look at this guy, and I'm looking at his name. I'm like, yo, he must be a Ghanaian. Mm-hmm. I come to find out that he is like a member of the Ashanti royal family and a member of the British royal family, a brilliant, brilliant scholar, a philosopher. And he was teaching the introductory course to Afro-American Studies. So I took it just because I wanted to know this guy.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I didn't have a strong understanding of like race and racial politics in the United States. So once I got into that course, I was blown away by the stuff I was learning and coming to understand why some of the things that I discovered in school were happening. And so I took another Afro-American Studies course the next semester. Then I took one the third semester. And then it got to the point where I wanted to study. I wanted to go back home. I wanted to study abroad back in Ghana to really dive deeper into issues that of how we're formulating an African identity. And the Afro-American Studies Department said that they would give me credit and I would graduate on time. And the government department would not give me credit. And so I went in with an interest in political science. And I ultimately wound up focusing in Afro-American studies and specifically comparative study of identity formation for Africans and African-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans.
So what do you think are like the most...
Hence, your first question is right up my alley. The first question you asked me is exactly the kind of stuff I was doing in school.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. So like, what do you think is, from everything that you studied, what do you think is like, the most important insights that you picked up that, like, you know, just any ordinary young African person today can really make an impact to his life or something that he should understand?
Honestly, the biggest thing that I learned is that, this is going to sound terrible, look, everybody is not as great as you think they are. and I say that not to imply that the world does not have a wealth of talent and wonderful, incredible people. It's just that even the best of the best have their flaws. And that was one of the most wonderful lessons from going to a place like Harvard where everyone is thinking, you're the best of the best, best of the best. And you know for yourself that there are things that you're not that good at or that you wish you were better at or things you really want to learn more that you could improve upon. But then you come to find out that everybody else that's there with you is the same way. It's simply a matter of how you understand yourself and what you're willing to make of yourself and of your life and of your opportunity. You should never look at anyone as greater than you, not any person, not any society. And this is not something that means that you are necessarily greater than someone else. My parents taught me always that I was special, but that didn't mean that other people were not special too. The biggest lesson I learned out of Harvard is that you create that specialness. You acknowledge and you accept what you believe you are, and then you make it a reality. And if people perceive you to be a certain way, then to some degree that perception becomes truth. So one of the big problems facing Africa is an identity crisis where we believe that Western products and goods are better, Western systems are better, Western places are better. We do not look internally to how can we create an environment in which we can thrive at home. And it's a hard thing. You know, there are a lot of reasons why so many of us are in the diaspora, but I believe that we in the diaspora have a responsibility to not only look back, but to go back and to do things for the upliftment of our home societies, for the pride and honor of Mother Africa. That is also bringing her to the table with people from all over the world to also share what we've got and to learn and accept what you've got too, right? To come, as I said in an interview once, to come to the global table as peers and not as peons. That is the biggest lesson that I would say to any young African who wants to make a difference. You think you got something to offer, then you do. Make it happen. If you believe you have nothing to share, then you don't. Step aside.
Wow. All right. So clearly, I mean, even from hearing you, I can hear that definitely like the public speaking thing was going to happen sometime. So
no, that's the product of the oral tradition.
No, West Africans do have the way of the words, man, but much more expressive than us folks from the East. But how did that public speaking thing happen?
know, man. First, it's not that we're more expensive than you guys. It's not we talk a lot.
That is also true.
You got to get good at it sooner or later, right?
Yeah.
The public speaking thing is interesting because I joke about the West African thing, but like literally, I mean, my father is an orator, and he is not as happy to be on stage as I am. He's not like a performer, but if you have my father, you sit him down and you ask him to express his feelings about something. I mean, he's incredible with words in three different languages. You know, my mother is. She's not an orator in the same way that my dad is. My mother is like a spirit. I mean, when my mother starts talking to you, she will get your blood going and will touch your very soul in the way. And she can do that in maybe four or five different languages.
Wow.
They both have a different approach, but they're both incredible at communicating. And that's what I grew up with my whole life, people who are just articulate and were not afraid to tell you exactly what they think, whether you like it or not. So when I was in high school, I had a number of friends who were kind of into social change and they wanted to do stuff for the black community. And I was still learning about like African-American culture and watching Malcolm X and the whole nine, Spike Lee, baby. And so when they were like, yo, we want to start this organization, we're going to do things, we're going to bring speakers to come and talk to us about things that young black men should know. And we're going to go and talk to other young black men about these issues. Yo, do you want to join? I was like, hell yeah, I want to know what's up. And so we would meet like every few weeks at the library, and we would have people come and talk about to us about things we thought were important. And then we would go and we would make presentations at youth detention centers about those same things that we thought were important. And so we began to, you know, I started doing public speaking, quote unquote, without knowing what it was when I was like 16 or 17. Then by the time I got to college, I mean, I took the lessons I learned in my high school organization, and I started an organization called the Harvard Black Men's Forum, which is alive and running to this day and is one of the more influential student groups at the university. And we call it BMF, which is our crew. And basically, I did that, and then I was part of the African Students Association, I was president of the Black Students Association, did all of these things that gave me an opportunity to, you know, express my ideas. And, you know, with the BMF, we created this celebration of black women, and we were honored. We honored this woman, Gwendolyn Brooks, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, God rest her soul, brilliant woman. We also we received an honor from the mayor of Cambridge and all this stuff. And because of these things, it raised the profile of our little group. You know, we'd start out with six people. It just helped us to be more and more. It got us to be more and more in the public eye. And I started being invited to like, hey, why don't you come and be on a panel for this? Or why don't you come and be in this like little youth TV program, talk about sexual violence on campuses? And why don't you come and speak at this community event in Cambridge to talk about youth empowerment? And I just started getting more and more opportunities to speak in public. And I was an actor. I was doing acting since I was a little kid. So I already had certain experience with like techniques for conveying an idea just like vocally and verbally and linguistically. But I started learning more. And then I was in class with like, you know, Cornel West and Henry Louis Gates and all these incredible people who had this powerful gift of language. And I started copying them and learning and watching what they were doing. So by the time I got to be a senior in high school, and I'm sorry, in college, I was being invited to give lectures at other universities. I'd been on like local TV programs and things like that. The year that I graduated, I was invited to give a talk in Trinidad, and they flew me out, and I gave a talk for like real people, like adults, as well as did a workshop for youth. And I was on television, and I was on the radio, and nationwide, the whole nine. And it's like, I got to the point where someone invited me once. I did a production for the people who did Eyes on the Prize. I narrated a documentary about African freedom struggles called Hopes on the Horizon. And basically, the woman, the producer, Judy Richardson, asked if I would like to do professional speaking. I was like, well, what do you mean? She's like, oh, I've got an agent. You should meet them. And, you know, they can get you paid to do speeches. And I was like, oh, well, I'll speak for free. I do it all the time. She was like, yeah, nah, homie. You don't get it, player. So she introduced me to her agency, and I had already a resume of speaking in so many places, and they were wondering what would it be like to have someone who is a college age speaking to college students. And they set me up on like one or two engagements, and it just blew up from there because there were not many people doing that. And that was my introduction to public speaking.
So you speak mainly to college students?
Well, not anymore. At this juncture, I do a lot of stuff. I mean, this year I gave a presentation in January for the United Nations, this thing that I call the Alliance of Civilizations in Madrid. In February, I did a speech for a major Fortune 500 firm in Toronto. Then in March, I did another one that was for an organization started by Deepak Chopra called the Alliance for the New Humanity. Meanwhile, I did a partner for a panel for another major technology firm. I did a thing for this firm doing marketing for some other large technology firms. Because I've been doing a lot of work in business and technology and entertainment recently over the last few years, I actually give a lot of presentations to organizations and whether for-profit or non-profit that are looking at how can technology and entertainment change the world around them. So I still do a lot of stuff in the educational sector, but it's definitely moved far beyond that.
So is there like a core message that you have, or do you have like a couple of core messages, or?
One of the core messages for me is really at the root of a venture that I'm launching called Take Back the Mic, which is based on the idea that, you know, young people of our generation, we need to start representing ourselves. We don't have to wait for MTV and BET to tell us who and what we should be. We need to look towards what is in our interest and build strength and leadership in art, society, business, and politics. And the underlying core premise of the whole project is that no society can develop without an understanding of its own worth. And that is something that I try to convey to people all the time. No one is going to save you. No one has the power to save you, right? The only way you can advance is to, A, believe and understand that you have something worth saving, and B, to comprehend that you have got the power to save yourself. After that, anything is possible. Without that, you're really crippled because you're always waiting for someone to be that hero for you. And there's nothing wrong with heroes. There's nothing wrong with looking up to others. There's nothing wrong with having admiration for someone who has lived an exemplary life or done things that you can admire. But ultimately, you have got to be the agent of your own success. And that really underpins everything that I do and everything that I talk about.
So what do you think is like the intrinsic value that a place like Africa has? Or does it vary from place to place and person to person?
Well, you know, Africa is so massive. And that is actually one of the great assets that we have, is we have so much human resources, intellectual capital, have physical resources and material goods. We've got access to all these corners of the world. We're right around the corner from Europe. We're across the water from Latin America. An 8-hour plane ride will take you direct from Accra to New York City. You could fly the other way and go to India in hours. I mean, we are centrally located right there by the Middle East, right? We're essentially located, and we've had so much influence from so many different cultures that you hear a language like Swahili is drawing from indigenous tongues as well as from Arab tongue, and it's created something that is now in an entire region, not just a country, but it's literally a pan-African dialect, if only for East Africa. I mean, you've got the ability when you look at the diaspora and you look at a place like the United States where African immigrants are the highest educated foreign-born population by far. You're talking about twice as many PhDs as immigrants from Europe, 48% more college grads than immigrants from Asia, earn 20% more than the average American, and 90%+ of them have got a high school diploma. Here, you're talking about a resource, a group of people who have got such intellectual capacity that it could not only be leveraged for the success of the society that they live in, but it could be leveraged for the upliftment of their community back home. I think that our culture and the way in which we revere our elders and the way in which we learn from them is of great value. I think the way in which we have learned that language has got power, and it's not just what you say, but how you say it, how that can be translated not only to the arts, but to business, to diplomacy, to governance. All of these are things that are of great value in a global world that is looking at how do we communicate across cultural lines. people talk about tribalism and conflict in Africa, but most often when you see these tribal conflicts, it's really economic imperatives that are underlying them. And oftentimes you've got external powers that are fueling the flames to get what they want, as well as internal powers that are selfishly looking towards their own self-interest as opposed to the interest of the society. But when you go back to my hometown, I mean, we could sit here with three of us in the room. I speak to you in your language. You speak to her in her language. She speaks to me in my language, just out of courtesy. You want to talk to me about tribal conflict? How many countries in the world can you go to where people will sit down and have a conversation in three tongues just to be polite to one another? Because they each obviously speak each other's. They could have picked one. I don't buy the idea that Africa is a basket case. I believe that Africa is a wealth of resource that the world can look to if Africans create an opportunity for the world to perceive the value in those resources.
So why do you think it is that, since Africa is predominantly young people, why do you think it is that these young African people don't participate in a more meaningful way towards building the society at home and in the diaspora?
Well, I think they face the same struggle that young people around the world face, which is how. You know, I want to make a difference. I want to do something great. I want to make a change. How? How do I do it? What do I do? They are all trying to figure it out. And the problem on the continent right now is some of the infrastructure for communicating, for educating people, for gaining access to information is not as robust as it should be. So I know kids who are spending time at the internet cafes. I mean, in Ghana, internet cafes in Accra, it's easier to find a cafe in Accra than it is in Manhattan. And it's kind of ironic. They're everywhere. But it's also because many people don't have access in their homes, right?
Yeah.
And so people are trying desperately to get information and to get access, and they're always online, and they're trying to plug things out or plug themselves into different networks. But the problem is, when you're paying by the hour, how much can you really do? How much time can you spend learning to program? You know, what can you do besides instant messaging here and there and sending some emails and things like that, right? So I feel like the challenge facing a lot of our young people is access to information on how they can make a difference in their own community. I remember going to the TED conference in Arusha last year in Tanzania, and there was a young man who was brought in from, I believe, I think Malawi. I forget, but I believe he was from Malawi. And he had gotten this book about windmills, and he was living in a village where they did not have electricity. And this kid read this book, and he said, I'm going to build a windmill. And he went out, and he built it. And he put his, he created electricity in his house, the first home in the village to get electricity. That's just indigenous ingenuity, homegrown talent. And now he's being supported and financed to learn more and to study and figuring out a model for how to build more and the bigger windmills to support electricity in the rest of his village. I mean, there's so much brilliance. And I would also say to your question, I know a lot of young Africans who are out there being engaged. And if you look at an organization like Taking It Global, I think the largest group of people on Taking It Global, the last time I checked, were from the U.S. or North America. The second largest were from Africa. Before Europe, Africans were all over the thing. We are out there hustling and trying and fighting to make our way. And I believe that in the next 5 years, you're going to start to see some of those fruits bounce up. You're going to see Africans in powerful positions and young Africans doing incredible things worldwide. And over the course of the next 10 years, we have the opportunity to really start bringing our interests globally to the table and having very strong arguments for what we need as opposed to just what we can get. But I think that we have to give our youth more access, not only to learn what they can do, but also to have their voices heard so that people can see what they are already doing.
And what about these folks who are already in the diaspora? What are your impressions on that? Like, you know, best educated group of people, are these us, African immigrants? Are we doing enough? Are we doing too little, too much?
Well, I think that you have really the evolution of what a friend of mine coined as the Afropolitan community. And that is those of us who have grown up in multiple countries and multiple languages. And all of us are not African per se. Some are Caribbean descent. Some are African American. But these are people who, you know, live in New York but speak with a London affect and love to chop fufu when they go home to their family in Lagos. You know,
yeah.
Eat some epa. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like that Afropolitan clique is just now coming to know itself. I think our parents' generation came out to study, and many of them got drawn into the Western lifestyle, and it becomes very difficult to, you know, develop debts in dollars and go home to pay them in CDs or in Naira, right? Yeah. So they wind up having stayed and seeing their children through school and such. But I think for our generation, who are now coming up and have finished school and have gotten graduate degrees or are pursuing degrees or are in the professional world now, it's time for us to step up. And many of us have been refining our skills and our chops, but we need to start applying them to what can be done for our people back home and for ourselves in the diaspora. I think there's nothing wrong with having the Africans living in the diaspora, living in the West, or even, I'm not one of those who ascribes that we must marry someone from your own village and all of this stuff. You know, you wind up with somebody that you met who's wonderful where you are, that's fine. But remember where you come from. Build a life, build a relationship with your work, with your spouse, with your dreams that enables you to come home, that enables you to start projects at home, that enables you to make investments at home, that enables you to launch ventures at home, that enables you to be a part of the life and the upliftment of your society, right? Yep. It's not as hard as people think. I'm not saying that everyone need to drop all your thing, quit your job at Goldman Sachs, and move back to Nairobi. I'm saying that you can commit to spending a certain amount of time in Nairobi. If your business is finance, learning what are the financial systems at home, where are the opportunities, where are the weaknesses, how could it be possible to maybe repatriate some capital to either launch or finance a venture that could take advantage of certain weaknesses in the marketplace that can make you money, that can be good for you personally, but that can also reinforce and support your community by leveraging the expertise that you've developed outside. That is what I think that we of the diaspora need to be doing, to getting more connected. And I don't feel bad. I think that now is the time to do it. We've been trained. We've been learning. Let's start putting it into action.
Hello, everyone. This is Mwangi. And just before the interview ends, I wanted to yet again encourage you, please head on over to facebook.com/soulfege, SOULFEGE, and join the Facebook group. And tomorrow when the album comes out, Take Back the Mic, please head on over to iTunes and buy it. Should you buy the album, please head on over back to the site, to thedisplacedafrica.com, and write a review, whether good or bad. Let me know what you think of the music. These guys are Afropolitan guys, really doing good work out there. So I really wanted to encourage them and want to help them and their album do as well as possible. Well, this has been Mwangi here from The Displaced African, the African Immigrants Personal Development blog. And to sound off, I'll play a little bit of Soulfege. Have a fantastic musical day, musical night, musical afternoon. Mwangi here, and I am out. Recognize every time it comes to sequel. Yo, so bad, gonna rise to the beat.